Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The undeniable and inexorable momentum towards a global economic model, and as a consequence of that fact, the accelerated growth of multinational corporate power and the ongoing consolidation of that power through merger and acquisition underlies the desirability and, for the sake of our planet and its inhabitants, perhaps the necessity of ethically driven decisions on the part of the leaders of those corporations and the fostering of an ethically sensitive culture within them. We'll talk about that today. But the goal of any discussion around corporate culture and the transmission of ethical values within an organization is, from my standpoint, a forum to provoke questions as opposed to one that provides answers. There are no easy answers, and ergo, there are no dumb questions. That's what I hope to do today, and I'll attempt to be brief in terms of presentation in order to allot as much time as possible for what I hope will be a robust Q&A segment. Aristotle stated that happiness is activity in conformity with virtue. The dictionary defines virtue as conformity to a standard of right. Based on that definition, it seems straightforward that the culture of any organization should direct that organization to conduct itself virtuously. In order to understand what that entails, I think it's necessary to define who are the constituents of a particular organization, and then to examine the standard of right that should be applied to each. In the case of the company for which I worked, Coca-Cola Enterprises, the constituents were, and this is not in any particular order, employees, customers, consumers, share owners, suppliers, the communities in which we operated, and the global community. And how do we, under the banner of doing the right thing or conducting ourselves virtuously, address each of those constituencies? Let me digress for a moment, because I feel we got to differentiate between what is right morally, and that's actions taken which aren't mandated by statute, and what's right legally, and that's actions taken by commission or omission that are subject to penalties imposed by law. And illustrative example might be of the moral versus the legal would be racial or gender discrimination. A pattern of either might result in fines, lawsuits, loss of government contracts, etc. Some form of minimal compliance is mandated. That's the right or proper thing to do legally. Setting a policy that our organization will operate without racial or gender bias, and a goal that within some reasonable time frame the organization will reflect the demographic character of the communities in which it serves, is a decision to do the right thing morally. That distinction having been made, what are the elements we identify as our moral obligation to each of the constituencies, and what are the choices we must make when doing the right thing for one constituent group has a deleterious impact on what we consider to be virtuous conduct towards another? Put another way, how do we or should we act when faced with an ethical dilemma? Note that I make no distinction between ethical, moral, or virtuous. From my standpoint, they're synonymous and they're interchangeable. So what are our moral obligations? First, to employees. And I think, you know, the most important single word we will use across the spectrum of those constituencies is fairness. So, you know, in terms of employees, we certainly have to offer them a fair wage. They should have job security, assuming performance, fair performance standards are met. They should have the opportunity for advancement based on performance. They should have acceptable working conditions and fringes such as health care and other things which employees would expect from an organization. Anything you can think of additionally, just chime in at any point in time. to our customers. You know, they deserve a reasonable profit from the sale of our product, and they deserve pricing terms and conditions consistent with those offered other customers. And if we've promised them a level of service, they deserve that level of service. To consumers, a value, a fair value. That's, our product should be worth the price. Quality. They would expect quality from that, from us, and they should get it. They would expect honesty in terms of not making false claims or claiming that our product will do something that it won't do. And product information, to the benefits, the harmful effects, all the ingredients, etc. To the local communities, we have a social responsibility, e.g. an environmental responsibility. We have the responsibility to make contributions in money or other resources towards programs which benefit the communities in which our organization operates and from which we derive profit. And to the global community, again, we come back to social responsibility. We should support the good. That's clean water, agricultural initiatives, the combating of hunger, etc. And we shouldn't support the bad. And that might be apartheid, repressive regimes, etc. And that's just a broad kind of view of each of those. And finally, we look at share owners. And, you know, they deserve an increase of the value in their investment. That means we move the share price up. And honesty and transparency in all the communications. We have an obligation not to deceive those people. And if you look at the Enrons or the WorldComs, et cetera, they dealt in intentional deception, quite frankly. Finally, to our suppliers, they should have a certain level of security on the business relationship based on fulfillment of commitments relating to the quality, service, and prices that they give us. I'd like you to keep those obligations in mind while I shift gears and talk for a few moments about how corporate culture can be changed, and having changed it, how it can be nurtured and institutionalized by leadership. Then we'll return to moral obligations and ethical dilemmas. I don't know, or I don't believe, that there's a formula for changing a corporate culture or for implementing and sustaining a new one. But I can give you an example based on my experience at CCE. When we took the reins at CCE, we found a company whose employees felt disenfranchised and unappreciated, whose customers felt the company was insensitive to their needs, whose market share had dropped significantly, reflecting consumer disaffection, and who had alienated a large percentage of the leaders in the communities that they served, and finally, whose relationship with suppliers were at best dysfunctional. By the way, not surprisingly, the share price of this company had dropped consistently for the 5 years preceding our entry. The one anomaly in this otherwise bleak scenario was that senior management, the leaders of the organization, treated themselves and were treated by the company very magnanimously in terms of compensation, perquisites, and job security. The company occupied 11 floors of offices in Atlanta, and all decisions relating to the conduct of the business all across the nation emanated from that building. Sadly, input from local operations was not solicited and was, in fact, discouraged. And it was immediately apparent to me that senior management not only did not welcome cultural change, but that they would actively resist it. The following are the steps we took to implement cultural change, and once in a while, you get lucky. You know, we had to do something fairly dramatic because I don't believe you negotiate cultural change, you impose it. And my first day, a secretary who had been assigned to me bought this big menu and put it in front of me. And I said, What is this? What do I do with this? And she says, well, it's the menu for the executive dining room. And I said, well, I'm not going to have time. You know, I'm new. I'm going to be at my desk all day long. I really haven't got time to mess with that. And she said, no, let's just fill it out. We'll bring you, you know, the menu every day. We'll put it, you just fill out the menu. We'll bring the food to your desk. I said, this is a pretty good deal. I said, what do I pay for this? We said, you don't pay anything. I said, that's interesting. I said, who else uses this executive dining room? You know, and she said, well, it's all the senior executives on the top two floors. And I said, and they don't pay anything either. She said, no. I said, take a memo. And take a memo. She said, yeah. I said, subject, yeah. I said, closure of executive dining room. And she said, well, I think you'll want to speak to the other executives about that. I said, I don't think I want to speak to anybody about that. And I went to the cadre of people that I'd bought in, because I also said, well, if we don't eat there, well, she said, well, you have to go down to the cafeteria. I got everybody who I'd bought to the company with me, and I said, okay, guys, off with the ties, roll up the sleeves, we're going down to the cafeteria. And when I got there, you know, somebody, who are you? I said, well, you work here now? I said, yeah, yeah. What do you do? Well, I'm president, you know. Yeah, and I'm Buck Rogers. What do you really do, you know? And I said, no, that's what I do. And the guy said, wow, this is something. Well, you can imagine the drums started beating and the effect across the company. I mean, people in Peoria, Illinois, and Nacogdoches, Louisiana knew about this within 2 days. So what it did is it sent a message, in a very strong message, that it was completely symbolic, but it sent a message that executive largesse was no longer acceptable. And as I said, the message, as intended, rippled through the company more rapidly than I could have ever believed possible. Having done that, we got to work. And what we did is we had to completely restructure the organization to reflect the local nature of the business. And we had to move from a totally centralized structure to a highly decentralized one and give local management the responsibility and accountability for the conduct of the business and the implementation of and adherence to the new company policies. We also had to identify those in management who would accept and endorse cultural change and who had the necessary operational expertise and move them from the office to field position. It's a kind of line versus staff mentality. And then to give the remaining management equitable separation packages and dismiss them. And we, you know, I have a view on that, and I used to be quoted on it. I said, we're not going to die the death of 1,000 cuts here. We will amputate, cauterize, and move on, which we did very, very quickly. And that might sound brutal, but actually it's the kindest way you can possibly do this because you don't want 70,000 people looking up waiting for the next shoe to drop. So having done that, we sent the new management team, including myself and the other newly appointed senior officers, to every location in the company as quickly as possible to convey our vision of the company's new culture and the individual responsibilities and accountabilities attached to it. We set about the task then of translating that philosophy into policy and put into place the mechanisms to measure, wherever possible, adherence to those policies. That's a kind of capsulized, oversimplified synopsis of our initial actions. But those actions sowed the seeds of a dramatic cultural change, which then led to a dramatic change in the fortunes of the company. Ours was, as it related to our employees, a performance-based culture. Performance against agreed-upon goals was tracked, ranked, and published throughout the organization. It was our goal, insofar as possible, to create a meritocracy, an apolitical environment within which everyone knew who the contenders for promotion were by virtue of their performance. Identifying the top performers, the future leaders, was also critical because in addition to providing those so identified with a career development path, it was imperative that we reinforce with them the importance of our corporate culture and their role in sustaining and nurturing that culture. The goals against which performance was measured were primarily sales and finance-related ones. But what if performance against those goals were achieved in spite of, not because of, no, I'm sorry, were achieved in spite of, violations of the company's ethical principles or policies. The moral obligations of the company to its constituencies that we laid out earlier. What if, in terms of being successful, you violate those policies? There are no foolproof methods for monitoring and correcting such situations, but I believe we can create an environment and the processes within that environment that can give you a high degree of comfort. And in order to achieve that, an organization must have open lines of communications, systems to ensure that vehicles exist for employees at every level to question or present grievances regarding actions which are inconsistent with the company's stated culture, with stated culture policies or goals, without fear of retribution. Now, admittedly, this system presents the opportunity for ill-founded or pithy complaints, but the cost of examining their merit is well worth the price. Additionally, while an individual's progress towards meeting the objective goals of the company is monitored regularly, we must put a process in place to identify and review the more subjective areas of performance, such as the ability to work with others, openness, communicative skills, etc. Those subjective areas must be subject to regular reviews with immediate superiors, identifying those areas which offer opportunities for improvement. Those areas identified must be mutually agreed upon and progress measured at regularly scheduled intervals. All of this was done for a reason, because I believe that when the conduct of a company is consistent with the ethical principles it has espoused, the company's constituencies, particularly its employees, will be loath to accept behavior on the part of anybody within the organization that is antithetical to those principles. That belief was validated by a personal experience I'd like to share with you. One of our divisions had been very, very successful in meeting all of its goals, sales, finance, return on invested capital, etc. The guy running it, in terms of his grade on results, was one of the top division managers. I spend around 80% of my time traveling. I kind of lived on my airplane because we decentralized the company, and I said, you don't come to me, I come to you. And in traveling, you get a good feel of what's happening in all the organizations. And also, you get a lot of feedback from people. Once they get talking to you, they talk. And I found that regardless of his success, this manager was violating almost every cultural precept the company was founded on. He was brutalizing his employees. He was the way he communicated with customers was unacceptable. He was absolutely political in all of his actions. And despite these outstanding results, I flew out and dismissed him. And this was the first time it had ever been done by me, certainly at this level in the company, and I didn't quite know how to handle it because I didn't know what the reaction of his peers would be. So I set up a meeting back in Atlanta, and I asked his 10 or 11 peers all to fly in. And I brought him into the boardroom because I wanted to explain very carefully what I'd done and why I'd done it. And I said, you know, look, we've made a move here, and let me explain. One of the guys stood up. He said, Henry, we know why we're here, and I've been asked to speak for the group. I said, yeah. He said, can I speak? And I said, yeah. He said, what the hell took you so long? You know, there's a great baseball axiom that fits in business in any organization. That is, you can fool the fans but not the players. And that taught me a great lesson that, again, you cannot allow anyone within the organization to begin a process of eroding the culture if you want the culture to stay the way you envisage it. Once you allow that culture to be violated on the basis of performance, otherwise, well, I'm going to look the other way because he performed well, then the culture is on its way out. So it was a pretty good lesson to learn at an early period. Assuming we've defined the culture of an organization as attempting to do what's right for all its constituents, how do we deal with the dilemma presented by actions which may benefit one constituency to the detriment of another? There's often no clear or uncomplicated right or wrong answer. And my real hope is that this course and others like it will help guide future leaders through an exposure and examination of how ethical conduct has been viewed and defined by the great thinkers, religions, and societies throughout the ages. As we live in an age of technological development, globalization, and a rate of change that could not have been envisioned decades ago, much less centuries ago, are the views and values espoused by those past writings valid today? My own view is that while societal change is ongoing and inevitable, ethical values and principles are constant. They are as applicable today as they were centuries ago. How many of you are familiar with or have read the Tao Te Ching? This is the Book of the Way. It was written just around 2,500 years ago by Lao Tse. I was rereading it the other day. And I'm going to quote from you what he had to say 2,500 years ago. When rich speculators prosper while farmers lose their land, when government officials spend money on weapons instead of cures, when the upper class is extravagant and irresponsible while the poor have nowhere to turn, all this is robbery and chaos. It is not in keeping with the Tao. That was 2,500 years ago. Not a lot has changed. I want to talk about something that's been getting a lot of attention lately, and that is justifiable attention, by the way, and that's executive compensation, or perhaps more accurately, the irrationality and even immorality of an increasing number of executive compensation packages. The first casualty of the current trends in executive compensation is the concept of accountability. And the first undercutting of that begins with what is called base compensation. You've all read about these absurd compensation packages. First of all, you know, if a compensation package is so high that regardless of the performance of the company, the CEO is enriched, there's something wrong with that. And the basis of these compensation packages, the rationale in most cases, is competitiveness. We have to pay this much to get a good guy, which is foolishness. But what we then do is hire consultants. There are compensation consultants out there. And we say to them, look, we want to pay Joe $3 million. And we're willing to hire you and pay you $250,000 to do a study for us that shows that Joe's salary is justified. What do you think the result is? The study comes out, and absolutely, if you hadn't paid that much, you wouldn't have gotten him. It's just, I don't know. As in Coca-Cola Enterprises, and in many, but not all companies, we had a policy that the higher the level of management, the greater the at-risk percentage of total compensation. You all know what at-risk means. That means you don't get it automatically, you get it based on performance. But at-risk should mean exactly that. That's performance achieved against stated goals. relating to profit, return on invested capital, market share, et cetera. Of course, there's a goal of increased value to share owners, which is addressed through stock options. And the logic of stock options is, you know, if the share owners benefit, the CEO benefits, and that the CEO doesn't benefit if share owners don't benefit. But that's been distorted, quite frankly. First of all, options are granted in time frames when the share price is at its all-time low, and everybody knows that. So there's a kind of automatic expecting. They've even gone so far as to reprice options, and that is to say, your options were $10 a share during your tenure. The company's share price dropped from $10 to $5. We're going to reprice your options at $5. Which, I mean, it's absolutely obscene. That means that if the share owners get back to even, this guy's doubled his profit. He's got 100,000 shares at a $5. He made $500,000 for doing nothing to improve the performance of the company. So, you know, basically, what we're down to is a situation where boards of directors have to act responsibly, not to protect the management of the company, but, as they should do, to protect those who've invested in the company. And, quite frankly, the violations of rational conduct insofar as executive compensation is concerned have gone out the window. You all, most of you, heard Cynthia Cooper speak, and if you didn't, you read what she had, and I assume everybody's familiar with that whole thing on WorldCom. And one of the questions was, you know, the harshness of the sentence against the CEO of that company, Bernie Ebbers. Got 25 years, which they said, you know, was equivalent to a life sentence because he's, what, 63 years old or something. And in my mind, the judgment against Bernie Ebbers was absolutely justified. And that opinion or conclusion is based on my view that the CEO or the head of any organization ought to be accountable for the actions of that organization and the impact of those actions on the organization's constituents. The widening gulf between the compensation of the CEO and that of the average worker within the CEO's company has been the subject of a lot of publicity and discussions. But equitability aside, if a CEO is being compensated at a level equal to 500 times the average worker in his or her organization, it doesn't seem untoward to me that that executive should be held to an exceptional level of accountability. It's my firm belief that one of the foremost roles, perhaps the most important role a CEO plays, is the development, nurturing, and sustainment of the corporate culture, that is, the guidelines and policies to which adherence is expected from everyone in the organization. If departures from or violations of that culture result in significant damage to any one of the constituents of that organization, the head of that organization should be held accountable. If the culture itself creates an environment within which malfeasance is acceptable or permissible, then too, the CEO is culpable and accountable. It seems nothing less than absurd to hear a CEO who's being paid millions say as a defense that he or she left the details of running the day-to-day business of the company to subordinates. As it relates to those subordinates complicit in the actions referred to, suffice it to say that the defense of "I was only following orders" went out with the Nuremberg war trials. In the particular case of WorldCom, it's noted that Ebbers' sentence was far more severe than that received by the company's CFO, Scott Sullivan, who was the architect of the accounting fraud. Ebbers' sentence was not too harsh. Sullivan's was too lenient. Now that I've got that off my chest. We can kind of move on to, first of all, before we get into any particular ethical dilemma, I'd like to just kind of answer any questions any of you might have. Yes.
Okay, so last week we were told that we should ask the hard questions, so because I'm going to do that. But you know, I have tremendous respect for you and all that you're teaching in this course. I'm really getting a lot out of it. So wrote this down. In the context of corporate social responsibility, as a director representing shareholders of Panamco, how do you justify what appears to be your negligence by ignoring atrocious human rights abuses commiserated by executives you were responsible for watching? And is this in part why you created this course to kind of—
The answer is no, and I think you're probably referring to Colombia.
Yeah,
Colombia. And in that case, the plant where this took place in Colombia was not part of Panamco.
Okay.
Actually, I never got to visit that plant because it was in territory largely held by FARC, by the revolutionary movement, and we weren't allowed to go in there for fear of personal safety. But it is interesting to note that the Coca-Cola company did conduct an investigation. First of all, in the case was brought to trial in the Florida courts, where the judge found the company not culpable. But then a commission was formed, and I think George Mitchell headed that commission, and found that they got no— that they didn't have those violations weren't proved. I can't speak to that area of Colombia. Again, it wasn't within our purview, but I know this, that— and that's an independent single bottler. That's the only place he owns. It is an area dominated, as I said, by FARC, and what took place there, I don't know. But I know this, and I have absolute confidence that as a matter of the conduct of their business, the Coca-Cola company would not and does not condone that kind of activity.
Well, maybe the article was misleading, but it seemed as if Coca-Cola had hired mercenaries or people who had intimidated union workers and in some cases killed them.
Let me explain how the Coca-Cola system works.
Please.
The Coca-Cola system is a franchise system.
Okay.
The Coca-Cola company in Atlanta, Georgia, franchises bottlers, and the bottlers buy the syrup and certain other agreements that they buy from Coca-Cola, but the capital investments, the plant equipment, et cetera, those are all the bottlers. I ran what was the largest bottling company in the world, not the Coca-Cola company, but it's the largest Coca-Cola bottler in the world. And the Coca-Cola company, in the franchise agreement, has the right to take that franchise away if we do certain things that are, you know, immoral or illegal or whatever. But the day-to-day conduct of the business in those areas is not run by the Coca-Cola company. It's run by the bottler himself. And the argument was that the bottler wouldn't have done it had not the Coca-Cola company condoned it. And my answer would be that, and I had a lot of years of experience with that company, I've never seen them condone any actions like that.
So why were you the defendant in the lawsuit case that was filed on behalf of the steelworkers?
No, that was thrown out. We were thrown out as defendants. We were because they made a whole list of the Coca-Cola company, franchise, Panamco, people who weren't in any way directly involved.
Okay.
But this was also a concerted effort on the part of international unions because they've had a waning influence. Union membership is down, and their influence has waned to a tremendous degree. And it was a move to try to solidify kind of the union movement and generate a what would one call it, a kind of coalesced effort to recognize, for greater recognition of the union movement across the spectrum of countries.
So has Coca-Cola distanced itself from agencies or groups that engage in those kind of practices?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And it has come out publicly and stated to that effect. Absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask, how did you keep an eye on your CFO because WorldCom and the other Enron, yeah, the things that I've read definitely point to the architect starting there. Not necessarily that he was it, but how do you keep an eye on the CFO?
Well, that comes back to the culture. First of all, in both cases, the CEO did it because he had CFO did it because he had marching orders. You know, keep the stock up at all costs. Now, whether or not he explains to you what he's done, or you say, I don't want to hear about it, just do it, you're equally culpable. I said before, I mean, the buck stops at the top. And if a CFO were doing things like that, then you as a CEO obviously had to know about it, unless you're sitting there and saying, look, I get paid, but I get paid just to sit here. I'm not supposed to look at anything. Never in the world. First of all, and by the way, and this is the value of a corporate culture, because without people below that CFO who knew that these were indefensible acts, having the courage to stand up. And again, remember I said you had to have the systems where they could, without fear of retribution. In our company, we'd have gotten a letter from the first controller he went to or somebody else, or he'd have called saying, hey, you know what we're doing here? We can't do this. First of all, quite frankly, I was close enough to the business, so I'd have known it anyway. And the very fact that the CFO knew that if he ever, ever did anything like that, he would be fired summarily had a lot to do with it, too. Again, it's the creation of a culture within which that kind of conduct is viewed as not acceptable. And again, if you get the rogue guy who's out saying, well, I'm going to break the rules and I'll be forgiven on the basis of improved performance, then the culture is gone. So, you know, that's the example I gave you. Anyway, it never could have happened in my company, period. And if it had, I would have been the one who ought to be held accountable for it.
Thank you. Because you just said that Coca-Cola was a franchise, I was wondering if you often had issues with monitoring the franchises and what the company did to make sure that that those franchises abided by the business culture that you were talking about.
Well, I was a franchise, so we were a franchisee of the Coca-Cola. There were two separate companies in the New York Stock Exchange. There's the Coca-Cola Company and Coca-Cola Enterprises. We were a franchisee, the largest franchisee in the world, of the Coca-Cola company. So we were the ones who had to adhere to the standards that were written within the franchise agreement. And the company has representatives in every country monitoring things like quality, which, you know, water, everything from water quality to packaging quality to conformance with local legal statutes, et cetera. That's monitored on an ongoing basis. So, you know, you can get some, again, rogue franchise who tries to do something, but in most cases, they'll get caught at it, and it'll cost them their business.
Thank you.
Do you see an ethical problem with Coca-Cola's sponsorship of the Beijing Olympics?
This is one kind of I was expecting. My wife is a great supporter and the Dalai Lama, so we've had these discussions. It is a dilemma, and there's no question about it. The question is, which way, you know, do you create more ultimate good? If the Coca-Cola Company, as an example, should say unilaterally, we're pulling out of the Olympics, that's going to have an immediate effect in China, obviously, the largest market in the world, where the Coca-Cola Company can count on not doing any business for a long time. That's going to have a deleterious impact on the value of the stock, which is going to certainly, you know, impact the share owners negatively. The thousands of employees in China who are working for Coca-Cola, who are being paid much higher wages than the average Chinese worker makes, will be out of jobs. The suppliers to Coca-Cola in that country, whether it's the suppliers of glass, cans, trucks, whatever, they'll lose that customer. So there's now, at the same time, offsetting that, you can say yes, but there's a tacit support of a repressive regime. On balance, and there are people who will disagree with me. I'm on balance. I would actually agree with the statement that the chairman of Coca-Cola made, and I'll read that to you. I'm writing in response to the letter from the International Tibet Support Network, the Coca-Cola Company. We share your concern regarding the situation in Tibet, and we know that all parties involved hope for a peaceful resolution. Our company, along with the other TOP sponsor, TOPS, has had regular discussions with the International Olympic Committee to share public concerns about issues that have been raised. While it would be inappropriate for sponsors to comment on the political situation of individual nations, as the longest-standing sponsor of the Olympic movement, we firmly believe that the Olympics are a force for good. Since 1928, we've supported the Olympic Games wherever they've been held and have witnessed firsthand the cultural, economic, and social benefits that they have in almost every instance brought to the host city and country. The Olympic Games can be a catalyst for change if people recognize the value of an event that brings tens of thousands of people together to celebrate sporting achievement at the highest level. Our role as a sponsor is to help build excitement and a sense of connection with the Olympic Games as the flame travels from city to city throughout the world. The torch relay serves as a driver to carry Olympic values to other venues around the globe. In 2008, our effort on the torch relay focuses on recognizing environmental champions, those who work tirelessly to protect our planet, and sharing the Olympic values of unity, pride, and inspiration with people all over the world. It's important to note the Beijing Organizing Committee for Olympic Games is responsible for selecting the routes and cities, as well as the planning and execution of the entire Beijing 2008 Olympic torch relay, both internationally and within China. The company plays no role in selecting the route. All the same, we believe that dropping out of the torch relay or using the event to put political pressure on China would erode the ability of the Olympic Games to make a contribution to lasting change in China and its relationship with the rest of the world. We're committed to retaining our support for the torch relay. Now, that's arguably a soft position. You know, you can say that's weasel wording, that's dodging. But the fact is that if you look at the company's kind of balance sheet in terms of the good it can create versus the repercussions that will cause damage to the company and its constituencies, I think that I'm in support of the company's position. I might note that while I was working, the Coca-Cola Company made a stand before most of your time. There was an Arab boycott in I think it was the late 60s, early 70s, of any nation that did business with Israel. And both Coke and Pepsi were told, get out of Israel or we will not do business with you in any of the Arab states. Coca-Cola refused to go along with that, and Pepsi got out of Israel. And Pepsi, as a result, was doing business in all of the Arab states and Coca-Cola in none of them until about 8-9 years ago, and that changed. But, you know, in that case, it was a little more clear-cut because you had a situation where at that time, there was an agenda, a stated agenda, about the destruction of Israel, and I think there was a little more moral clarity to it. But I think I could argue both sides of it. This is the quintessential ethical dilemma. And again, on balance, I support the company's position, but I can very well understand people who wouldn't. Yes, anybody. Okay.
My question was about India and the polluted groundwater situation there. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could comment about your responsibility to the global and local communities that way.
Well, the Coca-Cola Company initiated a study in India called the Assessment of Water Resource Management Practices, and it was done by a group called TERI, TERI, which was a scientific organization distinct from the Coca-Cola Company. It's a well recognized scientific group headquartered in India. And basically, I'll read another. Our engagement with Terry is another important step we're taking to ensure that our water management practices are consistently improving and among the best in the world. The report confirms that we meet Indian regulations and, on an overall basis, our own Coca-Cola Company standards, which are often more stringent. It also confirms that we're on the right track with many of the improvements we've made over the last few years. However, it identified some areas where we can do better. As a result, we're strengthening our plant siting requirements, our monitoring capabilities for both rainwater harvesting and wastewater treatment, and our guidelines for source protection and sustainability of the local water resource. And we've launched the Coca-Cola Indian Foundation for Sustainable Development and Inclusive Growth. We'll continue to work closely with the stakeholders in our local community to support community initiatives. Subsequent to that, the company received a bunch of awards for specific water programs in four different states where they've... it's fair to say that... without some level of pressure, they wouldn't have acted as quickly or aggressively as they did. So, I don't excuse them, but you have to understand that also water is a resource without which the Coca-Cola Company can't operate. So there's an enlightened self-interest there. If the water supplies become polluted, or endangered, it puts the Coca-Cola Company in danger, too. So there is a level of enlightened self-interest, but... I'm involved in the board of a company now that's spent tens of millions of dollars helping to reconstitute the Danube River. And there's a huge focus internationally on the part of the company on preserving and enhancing water supplies on a global basis.
I also had a question about the anecdote you related about the men who said, Why didn't you get him out sooner? Do you think that they should have said something to you? Do you think that falls into not necessarily an ethical realm, but
I think if it had gone a little longer, they would have. I think that was kind of a tongue-in-cheek, thing to let me know that that they were expecting action from me, and had I not. Done that expected action, if I hadn't done what they would have expected of me, then again, we would have seen a cracks in the culture, an erosion of the culture, because everybody would have said, well, wait a second. He's willing to overlook this one. What else? So I think that that while it acted as I think it did act to reinforce it, on the other side of the coin, had I done nothing, it would have endangered the culture.
Hi. So I have kind of a two-part question. First is, who are the franchisees in the third world countries? Is it governments or is it individuals? And is there one in every country or is it kind of by region? I'm not sure if that's...
It's multinational. I serve on the board of Coca-Cola Hellenic, which is a company that has the franchise for 23 countries in Europe, including Russia. I mean, it's huge. In some cases, there might be five or six franchisees within a given country. In China, that was the case. In no cases is any government the direct franchisee of the Coca-Cola Company.
And more specifically in Africa?
And I'm not that familiar with Africa. I know the company that I'm on the board of is the franchisee in Nigeria. The company itself... owned a couple of franchises, and this is where if the company can't find a viable franchisee, they'll go in and run the operation themselves, which they do in Kenya and I think Tanzania. But Africa has been a very volatile and difficult environment for the company. And it's the one area where I'm really not that familiar with the franchise structure.
Okay. So the second part of my question is maybe not specific to Africa, but sort of along the lines of the tobacco discussion, it's probably not the healthiest product for people. And in the third world, I've noticed on numerous occasions that sometimes it's cheaper than water. And I don't know. I don't know how you feel about that, if there's anything that you can... say that goes along with that.
Well, you know, it's cheaper than most waters in the United States. But, you know, I was bemused by the fact that a number of years ago, when gasoline got to $2 a gallon, people were saying, "My God, $2 a gallon for gasoline," and they were paying $2 for a 1 liter bottle of Fiji water. So, you know, I think there's, you know, I think it's not necessarily the price of Coca-Cola, but the price of water. And now, in most business, the Coca-Cola company has not, and part of the thing that we did when the Coca-Cola company described itself as a soft drink company, and we went to them and said, we're not a soft drink company. We're in the liquid, non-alcoholic refreshment business, and that means juices and waters and whatever anybody will consume of a non-alcoholic nature, we should be in the market. And we got into the water business in a big way, and Coca-Cola is in the water business in almost every country now. And in sub-Saharan countries and places like this where potable water is a real issue, it isn't the manufacturing of the water that's the issue. It's the distribution systems to try to get it out to the people who need it, which is a huge issue. But you'll note whenever there is a disaster of any kind, if you look carefully, you see that the Coca-Cola company is there providing water, not Coca-Cola. It's water. And insofar as, you know, Coca-Cola was designed as a moment of simple pleasure. You know, it's a drink. It's got sugar and some CO2 and some water in it, you know, and some caramel and a little cola. But, you know, it's nothing that was meant to be consumed or is consumed, as far as I know, in huge amounts on a daily basis by anybody. And the only instance I found where probably I would have changed my view is we got into a situation when I was running the company where we aggressively got into very aggressive competitive bids for secondary schools in the United States. The contracts were huge. I mean, you get the public school system in Denver, Colorado, and pay millions of dollars to supply them for 10 years. But the schools made a fortune off it. And they said, you know, we're supporting the band, and we're supporting this program and that program. And probably at that time, you know, I didn't think about it, and I didn't think, I saw nothing wrong with it. Now today, you know, I would have a very much changed view. I might have it available at some level, but 90% of the availability would be in products like water or juices or isotonic beverages or whatever, as opposed to colas, because, quite frankly, the obesity issue. And the obesity issue wasn't an issue, quite frankly, then. And I got my own personal view that it's lack of exercise rather than diet that's causing most of it, but that's something I won't get onto now.
Thank you.
Hearing your like bio, it just seems like you've had a lot of success with your like pursuit of like running an ethical business. But I mean, are there downsides to it? Why isn't everyone doing the same thing? You know, there's got to be difficulties specific to you because you have chosen to pursue like such an ethical like business model or management model.
You hit the word on the head, and that is difficult. It would be, you know, if you're not presented with ethical dilemmas on an ongoing basis, or if you're too obtuse to recognize them when you see them, then life's a lot easier. But basically, it's far more satisfying to conduct, you know, to conduct yourself in a consistently ethical manner. But it is more difficult because, by virtue of your sensibility to your own ethical sensibilities, you create dilemmas that other people might not recognize as dilemmas. And that tends to strengthen your ethical conduct, but it also says you're going to make a lot more of those kinds, you're going to have a lot more of those kinds of dilemmas than somebody else might. So, you know, why people don't do it, I don't know why people steal. I don't know why people cheat. But they do. And you've seen, gosh knows, a lot of examples of that in the past number of years. I mean, when people, you know, if the Enrons of the world, I mean, you would say, how can people do that to other people? And my answer is, I don't know. I think greed has an enormous amount to do with it. But I found it very, very I found it difficult and simultaneously comfortable to conduct our business in that manner.
This question probably would have been more relevant earlier when we were touching on water and global relations. But I wrote down here, the seizing, pollution, overexploitation of vital water resources in India, Mexico, and elsewhere is a normal practice employed by Coca-Cola and Pepsi. In these countries mentioned, over 2 million people die each year due to water shortage and related illness. That's a fact. And this company profits millions from taking water resources from where they're direly needed and dispensing them to places
and using them elsewhere. And I would argue with that.
Okay, well,
because I think that's not true, and okay. I think in, you know,
what would your stance on that
the what's the young woman in India who's
yeah,
and she's got, I mean, by virtue of her, she believes, and it's her belief that multinationals are inherently evil. I mean,
that's not where I'm coming from.
No.
And I actually don't know who you're quoting. I've done research myself, and I do know that people all over this world, particularly in these parts of the world, are dying because of water shortage.
I'm not asking,
because earlier we touched on Coca-Cola's policy towards water, and you even said that they have water programs that they've put into practice and that, you know, water is water and everybody needs it. But personally, do you feel that there's an ethical dilemma there, taking water? Lots of, like, vast amounts of water
vast amounts of water without replenishing the system, and without, actually, it is my belief that we have an obligation, and I think that obligation is being fulfilled today, to diminish water resources, but to enhance and improve them. And that relates not only to the amount of water, but the potability of the water. In many cases, water exists. And if you drink it, you die, or get terrible diseases, amoebic, dysentery, et cetera. And the Coca-Cola Company and other, they're not alone, other companies are working not only to enhance the supply of water, but as importantly, or perhaps more importantly, is to purify the existing water and allow it to be potable so particularly young people can drink the water without getting long-term diseases. And the Coca-Cola Company has been very much involved in those programs.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.